Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited, the only science podcast that was given an altogether lukewarm endorsement by the outgoing Prime Minister. Well, all I can say is this. Look out, Gordon. Tony will tell you the sort of influence we have. On this week's soon-to-be-historic show, we look back on 100 years of fantastic plastics with Dr. Susan Mossman from the Science Museum. Plus, we discuss the new Encyclopedia of Life project. What do you have to say about the plan to catalogue our biosphere? And we go further than any podcast's ever gone before to conduct an interview at the peak of Mount Everest. Well, sort of. All this and your regular dose of music, nonsense and bad puns. I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Let me introduce this week's collection of angels with dirty faces, otherwise known as the Science Weekly Pod Squad. First up, of course, it's tech correspondent and amateur human cannonball, Bobby Johnson.
Always good to see you, Alok. I don't see enough of you these days.
Yeah, you have moved. I'm missing you already. It probably won't interest anyone else, but until this week, Bobby sat opposite Big Papa Science himself, Mr. Ian Sample. An emotional reunion, Ian?
It is. I just got to my desk this morning and there was a big space where Bobby used to be. And it's like, oh, he's gone then.
Well, he's back.
A sad moment.
Captain Nell Bowes from Guardian Unlimited's arts blogs just arrived on her schooner.
Hello, shipmate.
And a very quick hello to the absent James Randerson. He's away on his stag do. Frankly, I'm a bit disappointed that I wasn't invited. But finally, producer Ben Green's also here, looking typically lonely and confused. Now, Benjamin, come here, son. I want to say one word to you. Plastics. God bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey, hey. Well, this is probably the most oblique introduction we've ever done, and believe me, Ben and I have come up with a few. Hopefully at least one of you out there will have sussed our references to the graduate this week. For the rest of you, go and watch the film again, and we'll move swiftly on. Our special guest this week is Susan Mossman from the Science Museum. Susan's currently head curator of a new exhibition called Plasticity, 100 Years of Making Plastics. It does exactly what it says on the tin, detailing a century of plastics from Bakelite to biodegradable cars. Susan, welcome to the pod. Now, where we're used to plastics being all over the place, phones, computers, everywhere, and one of the most unusual, unexpected uses of plastic.
Well, I suppose one of the most surprising ones, it's a material right at the end of the other scale from Bakelite. We're displaying a concept car, which has been developed by Toyota, and it's got a shell. It's called the I-Unit. It looks like a tiny spaceship. I mean, it's quite a strange shape. It's silver in colour, but it's made of a plant-based plastics material, and it's got the shell made of a biodegradable plastics.
And what's the idea? Is it that after 20 years of using it, just sort of shove it in a field and it sort of biodegrades and fertilises your crops for you or something?
Well, I think it's a combination of, one, it's biodegradable, it'll break down, but also it's lighter, so it's going to save you fuel on that vehicle. So it's got all those assets to it. And it's bizarrely looking as well.
That whole biodegradable thing is very important, isn't it? Because plastics are sort of also seen as a bit of a bane around sort of especially cities and things. I mean, plastic bags clutter up all our streets and we're trying to stop using them. I mean, what are researchers trying to do to sort of cut down this waste almost?
Well, I think it's a combination of certain materials being developed that are biodegradable. For you want your bottle of water to be biodegradable. They developed a bottle that now apparently degrades in 12 weeks. Recycled plastic bags, you can recycle them, reuse them, biodegrade them. Also, people have to take responsibility. Obviously, people are now bringing out, supermarkets are bringing out bags that are made of a strong plastic that you can reuse, that bag for life. I mean, that's a good idea. So you can use it, it has more than just one use. Obviously, people themselves have to think about how they use it. Are they responsible with their own way of dealing with them? So make sure you use it more than once.
Ian, you've got a question?
Yeah, are you getting any feel for what we might be possible with plastic electronics, like bendy sort of computers, computer screens, things like that?
Yeah, we're showing some of those. We're showing some of those sort of bendy plastics. There's an interesting company, Plastics Logic, in Cambridge, who are developing a lot of interesting electronic plastics. So that ultimate bendy plastic of the future, that your screen might be, or your TV screen would be on a bendy plastic material.
So you can just roll it up and put it in your pocket.
Oh, yeah. And also we're showing, I suppose, a really sort of top-end stuff. We're showing sort of models of some of the polymers that they might go into shape-changing planes. And that's anything from electronic plastics to shape memory plastics to composite plastics. That's sort of composites together with other plastics or other materials. So a whole range of materials are put into this plane that will... It changes really from plane shape to a bird shape, but it can change as the flight changes. So that's work that began at NASA, then has been devolved, and so that's beginning to get into the commercial sphere. And they've been thinking about it. It's that whole area of what we call smart materials that people have been thinking about for a while.
Why would it change shape? Is it because for fuel efficiency or to?
Well, it could be. It depends what speed you want. There might be. I mean, I'm not a pilot, but you obviously might want to change the way for airflow reasons, etc. Depending on the, and again, if you want to go. Sort of Mach 1 or something like that, there might be aerodynamic reasons. I mean, Concorde, you remember, is very sort of tall and long and pointed. I mean, you might want to sort of imitate that sort of shape, but you might not want that shape all the time. So it's a flexible plane shape. So we're going to be showing some of those sort of stories.
Bobby, just going back to one of those points we made earlier about the flexible paper and sort of electronic things like that, you must have come across this sort of stuff all the time.
Oh, yeah, there's tons of research going on, and a lot of it in Britain as well. I mean, it's you know, we're in a mixture of the kind of hardcore plastics work, electronics work, and nanotech work as well. There's a lot of kind of overlap between all of those, and there's a lot of movement going on in Britain. I was just wondering, though, you know, I'm looking around us now, and we've all kind of, we're decked out with plastic here, there and everywhere. People listening and probably can see dozens of bits of plastic wherever they look. Where would we be if we hadn't had plastic 100 years ago?
Well, of course, remember, we've got a whole range of materials. It's the animal, vegetable, mineral. But we're showing a fabulous film called The Fourth Kingdom, which talks about plastics as the fourth kingdom. So it's that extra dimension, and it can do that thing. Also, mass production. It's cheaper and simpler to produce in mass numbers. And also, mouldable and changeable and adaptable, because we're into a whole generation of sort of, I suppose, adaptive and responsive materials that we can adapt to really what we need it to adapt to. So it can be degradable, it can be sustainable, it can have a long life if you want it. There's a whole range of applications that we can develop.
How important do you think it's been to, you know, some of the technological and scientific developments that we've seen over the last 100 years? Would we have had computing without plastics?
We had wooden computers.
Well, you can imagine your mahogany computer, can you? I mean, or your mahogany phone. And phones used to be made of wood and metal. And of course, the plastic phone. And that was a key thing. Leo Bakerland, he ran a design competition to design the perfect Bakelite phone. He then ended up hiring a key American designer, Henry Dreyfuss, to develop that special, I suppose, iconic Bakelite phone that everybody knows about, that we're familiar with. And think about your phone. You couldn't imagine your phone made of any other material. But, of course, at this end of it, we're now beginning to make phones of biodegradable and sustainable material. So it's thinking right through. So it really goes back to, it's a sort of light, flexible, convenient material.
Susan, do you think these materials have sort of gone through this age where they were made using the absolutely most environmentally horrendous industrial processes you could pretty much imagine, with emissions and such like, and all these sort of organic chemicals and so on? I think that is kind of a bygone time which has seen these materials come to the fore, but now it's really a pressure on to come up with green chemistry and you know, is the environmental pressures becoming really significant in this area?
Well, I think it's that whole element, isn't it, of green design, that people have to think about the life cycle of a material and that cradle-to-cradle business. So people have to take on board all those particular aspects. So obviously it's going to be entering into any new plant that you build. You want to make sure that your material is as environmentally friendly as possible. You also want to make sure that you dispose of your waste at the end of it, or it becomes the raw material for another process. It's really thinking clever how one process feeds into the other, and just being aware and being conscious of how this might be implemented.
Well, Susan, thank you very much for that. The exhibition, Plasticity, 100 Years of Making Plastics, opens at the Science Museum on May 22nd. And you can get more details at www.sciencemuseum.org.uk. I'm Alok Jha, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, we speak to the explorer who's going back to the future in his quest to climb Mount Everest again. Plus, Jim Edwards, the head of the new Encyclopedia for Life project, tells us about the plan to catalogue every single plant, animal and microorganism on Earth, and to put all that information on the internet. It's all coming up, of course, but first, it's time for a roundup of the other science and tech news that's been making headlines over the past 7 days. This, ladies and gentlemen, princes and paupers, is the News Jam.
News Jam.
Climate change may have passed a key tipping point that could mean temperatures rise more quickly than predicted. Scientists say that a previously unexplained surge of carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere in recent years is due to more greenhouse gas escaping from trees, plants and soils. At the moment, around half of human carbon emissions are reabsorbed by vegetation, but new research suggests that increasing temperatures are reducing this effect.
Here's a blast from the past. The Natural History Museum has returned the remains of 17 indigenous Tasmanians to Australian Aboriginal leaders. The museum had agreed to return the remains, which include teeth, skulls and other bones that had been removed from the island in the 19th century, but not until research had been carried out on them. The Tasmanians viewed the tests as a desecration and took the museum to the High Court. The two sides have now agreed that 4 DNA samples from the specimens will be preserved in Tasmania for research.
Bats and birds have evolved two completely separate evolutionary solutions to the problem of flight, and they therefore use completely different wing motions. Archaeopteryx, the dinosaur ancestor of modern birds, developed its method around 150 million years ago. But bats are relative newcomers to the skies, appearing around 50 million years ago. New research, published in Nature, could provide new ideas for engineers who are designing more manoeuvrable robotic planes. Maybe plastic ones.
And finally, British scientists are finalising plans for an ambitious experiment to discover ancient high-speed particles from the far side of the universe by listening to them plop into the ocean. In a 200-metre-deep trench off the west coast of Scotland, the researchers will use hydrophones to listen for high-energy neutrinos. Those are particles that are predicted to exist, but which have never been detected. The particles will shed light on the structure of the universe soon after the Big Bang.
And that was your News Jam. Thank you, Nell and Bobby. You make this reading out loud business seem like child's play. Susan, I'm going to come to you first. You heard the story there about the Natural History Museum that had to return the 19th century remains of the Tasmanian Aborigines. Where do you think museums need to draw the line between sort of using things that people might consider sacred to them and the sort of advances in knowing what we need to know about the future and DNA research and so on? Has the Science Museum ever come against this sort of problem before?
In our new welcome wing, which opened in 2000, we do display an ancient body. And again, we had to be very, very careful how we displayed it. So we made absolutely sure that we displayed it with respect, etc. And again, we did have a Peruvian mummy on display in our welcome galleries, and again that's been removed from display. So again, it's that sort of look. And of course, we're not the British Museum, where you've got the Egyptian collections and they've got a completely different set of issues. So again, it's considering how you might use these things in an appropriate way.
I suppose there is that sort of colonial aspect to this, to going into different countries and taking up their archaeological remains. Personally, I think it's right that the remains have been returned without any research necessarily, but what do you guys think?
On a different subject, I wondered if anyone could actually explain the difference in the way that a bird and a bat flies to me. I'm throwing this out to you science guys now, because this isn't my area, but anyone got any ideas?
Ian, you, I'm going to throw this one to you.
No, for all the podcast listeners, so this is how the bird does it. And this, I think you'll find, is how the bat does it.
So I would say more of a swimming motion.
I'm illuminated, and I'm sure this is why
we need vodcasting or whatever it is with videos. Maybe not. We'll leave that there. There's probably videos that explain
we'll link to a video, because yeah. I'm going to go and find this out now.
Thank you for that, everyone. If you've got anything out there you want to say or add to any of these topics, send us an email or post a comment on the blog. Details coming up at the end of the show.
Is the name of the game, and I want to play the game with you. Life can be terribly tame if you don't play the game with two. And I want to play the game with you.
Nice to see you.
Nice.
Oh, dear God. Right, as Brucey said, life is the name of the game. And when the great E.O. Wilson, who's universally regarded as the godfather of ecology, accepted the 2007 Technology, Entertainment and Design Prize earlier this year, he stated that he had one desire: to try and catalogue all the known species on Earth and make all the results available as a continuously evolving online resource.
We need to have the biosphere properly explored so that we can understand and competently manage it. We need to settle down before we wreck the planet, and we need that knowledge. This should be a big science project equivalent to the Human Genome Project. It should be thought of as a biological moonshot with a timetable. So this brings me to my wish for Tedsters and to anyone else around the world who hears this talk. I wish we will work together to help create the key tools that we need to inspire preservation of Earth's biodiversity, and let us call it the Encyclopedia of Life. What is the Encyclopedia of Life? It is an encyclopedia that lives on the internet and is contributed to by thousands of scientists around the world. Amateurs can do it also. It has an indefinitely expandable page for each species. It makes all key information about life on Earth accessible to anyone on demand, anywhere in the world. Today, the practicalities of making such an encyclopedia, regardless of the magnitude of the information put into it, are within reach. Working together, we can make this real. The encyclopedia will quickly pay for itself in practical applications. It will address transcendent qualities in the human consciousness and sense of human need. It will transform the science of biology in ways of obvious benefit to humanity. And most of all, it can inspire a new generation of biologists to continue the quest that started for me personally 60 years ago, to search for life, to understand it, and finally, above all, to preserve it. That is my wish. Thank you.
E.O. Wilson there, giving his acceptance speech for the 2007 TED Award. Well, his dream is now in the process of becoming a reality with the Encyclopedia of Life project. Its executive director is Jim Edwards, and I spoke with him earlier. I began by asking what sort of data they'd be recording.
We're talking about databases developed by the scientific community, molecular sequences, molecular barcodes, physiology, behavior, ecology, ecosystems. Wherever species name is a field that we can index that will allow us to link that species name to a particular site, then we can put links to those databases. So this means we can really get into much of the knowledge about biological diversity.
So looking forward then, I mean, once this database is sort of established, if I'm an ecologist and working in Mexico, for example, and I want to use this database, you know, what kinds of actual scientific research will I be able to do?
Well, what you've just mentioned is exactly the kind of thing we think that this resource will be best used for. Not only will we have the descriptions of the species, but also we'll have information about where specimens of it have been collected, with latitude and longitude and date of collection attached to that. And we'll also have observations of the species. And so that means that you can track through time and space changes in the species habitat, species range. You can model how it's responding to things like climate change and human interventions into changing the land. You can use it to look at invasion pathways of endangered species. You can model where they're likely to be able to come into your country, set up interdiction stations to watch for it, and utilize the reports of where it's being found to see if the species is moving into your country. And it's interesting you mentioned Mexico, because Mexico has what is probably the best database of any country in the world about its own biological diversity, and it's already used that database to do all of the things I just mentioned in understanding and managing its own biological diversity.
So it sounds like a fantastically useful resource. I suppose the obvious question is, why hasn't this been done before?
Two reasons. The first reason is we didn't really have the software tools until quite recently. The second thing we didn't have was money, and two private foundations have now agreed to provide $25 million. That amount is going to be matched by fundraising from the core institutions involved in the Encyclopedia of Life. So we're going to have about $50 million to do the first 5 years of this project, and we expect the whole project will take about 10 years.
And then it will, I assume, have to be maintained beyond that. So who's going to own this information? Which institution?
Information actually will continue to be owned by the people who have provided it. Let's say you've set up a database with information about butterflies, and you agree to serve some information about butterflies to the Encyclopedia of Life. You'll continue to own that information. It will credit you with having provided that information on the species page. The species pages themselves will be made freely and openly available to anyone, anywhere. We are not going to put any restrictions on their use or distribution by other people.
That was Jim Edwards speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Ian, you've been looking at this Encyclopedia of Life project. There are quite a few British institutions involved.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to overstate the enormity of this project, and it's just staggering, really. I mean, Kew Gardens are on board. We know the Natural History Museum are on board, or the Field Museum in Chicago. But just one of those, the Natural History Museum, they were saying that they've got arguably one of the largest collections of scientific material in the world, in one of the most expensive cities in the world. And so for visiting scientists, really hard to get hold of this sort of information. And they want to put something like a million books and about 250,000 journal papers onto this encyclopedia. And that's just one institution. It's just an absolutely staggering amount of information.
Bobby, Jim Edwards also touched on how they're going to create this thing. What it sounds like is a Wikipedia and a mashup altogether, and I don't understand either of those words. How's this going to happen?
Well, okay, so as far as I understand it, they're going to start off by going out and getting information from institutions, from kind of publicly held knowledge, also from just, you know, scraping the web for as much information as they can find, and a lot of stuff that's already out there through intelligence software that goes out and gets the stuff it needs. Then they're going to vet that information, and they're going to mix it, or mash up, as Podcast 2.0 would put it, with things like videos that have been taken of the species in question and maps that are on the internet. Loads and loads of information. And I think it's really interesting in terms of the way they're trying to harness, you know, knowledge all over the place. I mean, we've seen Wikipedia trying to do this in a very general sense, but, you know, scientists haven't necessarily banded together and supported that. There are other projects, one called Citizendium, which is trying to do a similar thing, but with academics. And then you've got an organisation like Google, which is spending millions and millions and millions on digitising libraries of information to try and, you know, to try
make them
and build
accessible.
Up, yeah, build up their,
I mean, that's,
database.
That's something that Ian mentioned before about the books that Kew Gardens and Natural History Museum have got. There's millions of volumes of this stuff written 50, 60 years ago, before we had computers everywhere. I mean, how does that stuff get into the databases?
I mean, there are other projects. You know, here in the UK, there are a couple of really big projects. There's the British Library is scanning in millions of books. The Bodleian Library in Oxford is scanning in loads as well. The sheer volume of information, and then what you can do with that information after you've got it in a kind of digitized form that you can search and you can analyze. You know, it's really amazing.
Now I'll leave the last question to you.
One of the main problems with taxonomy is what you choose to classify things by, and the difficulty of choosing one system that you then have to maybe fit awkward things into. How are they going to structure this thing, do you know?
You're right, especially if they're asking for amateur input on this as well. There has to be an easy way for them to an easy taxonomy for them to use. And whether they use a kind of a bottom-up one or a top-down one, I think will be crucial in exactly how this gets rolled out. You know, if they come up with a big document that says, this is how you have to structure the information you give us so that we can understand what we've got, or whether they say, we're going to analyse that, we're going to see how many times certain words are mentioned, or we're going to allow you to just simply tag it and create what's called a folksonomy rather than a taxonomy, that kind of builds up from nothing and just uses the information that's already there. I don't know what they're going to use, but I think it's going to be really important. There's 1.8 million things on this database, you know, it's going to be massive.
I think Jim Edwards was saying that all the information they collect together is going to be automatically dumped for a species, for example, onto one page, which then is going to be checked by an ecologist. I mean, there is a human expert involved in all of that. Anyway, you can go and check out the Encyclopedia of Life at eol.org. There's not much there at the moment, but in 10 years' time, there'll be loads. Now, for explorers and mountaineers, conquering Everest still holds an almost mythical importance. Many have tried and even more have failed, some tragically so. One man who's giving it a go is the American climber Conrad Anker. He's currently leading a team of 12 to the world's highest peak. With one proviso, they're doing it wearing 1920s climbing clothes. It's for a documentary about the final journey of the two pioneering English climbers, George Mallory and Sandy Irvine, who died while trying to reach the top of Everest in 1924, 29 years before Sir Edmund Hillary became the first person to do so. By recreating the route and conditions of Mallory and Irvine's trek, the team are trying to find out more about the physical and neurological conditions experienced by the pair. Well, before he left for his stag do, James Randerson kindly carried out his podcast duties for the week. He spoke to Conrad at his base camp on Everest to find out more about the expedition.
We have an original clothing replica outfit, and we've got tents, stoves, and the clothing that they wore. We tried it on. We put it on in a sort of more domestic setting, so to say, and now we'll be trying it out in the mountains. So there's two aspects of this. One is the scientific sense. How warm was it? What was it like? And the other one is sort of the more spiritual sense, to get in the mindset of Mallory and Irvine. So my partner, Leo Holding, and I will be in period clothing and equipment, try to get into the spirit of them.
So are you literally going to try to get to the summit while wearing kind of tweed jackets and hobnail boots, or are you going to just wear them perhaps on somewhere a bit lower down the mountain where it might be a bit safer?
Looking at the clothing, it would be ideal to make it to the summit in them, but I'm also a realist. I've climbed Mount Everest, and it's a very harsh and unforgiving environment. So we will probably take it as high as 23,000 feet and then switch over to modern-day clothing. It's a great way to honor them, but to climb all the way to the summit with that clothing would be taking on more risk than either the team or my teammate Leo and I would be willing to accept.
And you're also taking physiological measurements of the people as they're climbing. What sort of measurements are you taking?
There's two measurements that we will be taking. One is the heart rate, which increases with altitude, and the other one is O2 saturation, which decreases with altitude. When you're at sea level, you'll have a O2 saturation level between 95 and 99%. As you go higher, it decreases. For instance, if you were in a hospital setting and someone has an O2 saturation of about 60%, they are in very dire condition. They're usually then put on supplemental oxygen. People operate here on Everest with an O2 saturation probably in the 80 percentile.
So they're pretty close to being critical in a way. I guess it's interesting to understand how the body can cope at those kind of extremes.
Yeah, the body adapts to it, but please realize once you get above 21,000 feet, the body is slowly deteriorating. Human life was not meant to exist at this altitude. About the highest permanent locale is here on the Longboat Glacier at an elevation of 16,000 feet, and the Tibetan monks that live there have adapted to the altitude, and you can maintain, but bump up 5,000 feet to 21,000 feet, and the body is slowly deteriorating.
Okay, we're almost done for another week. Before we go, let's have another word with our special guest, Susan Mossman, head curator of the new plastics exhibition at the Science Museum. Susan, we've talked a bit about the history of plastics and kind of where we would be without them, wooden computers and mobiles being one of the things. And let's look at the next century of stuff. And where are we going with unusual and unexpected uses for plastics?
Well, there's anything from alternative sources of plastics, so plant-based plastics and other raw materials. There's also a developing field in medical plastics, because that's these materials, for example, anything from drug delivery systems that are encapsulated in plastics to there's a lot of plastics used in engineering in the body, bioengineering. They started with contact lenses and false teeth. You've now got polythene around your hips, your hip joint. You've got polyester and nylon in some of your veins and that type of application. Your artificial heart valves,
they use plastic. So it could actually help mend some of our bodies as well.
There's even plastic blood, I've heard.
Yeah, this is a new development that a team at Sheffield have been developing. And what's quite interesting, where they think they might be able to use it is in the field, in an emergency situation where they just need some blood very fast.
Ian, you're a man who's a bit of an expert on the medical uses of materials, aren't you? And probably have polythene around your hips too. What would you like to see plastics being used for? Or do you think they will be used for in future?
No, I did do a lot of research on using polymers in the body, and I did find it interesting, especially in the first 6 months, three-year stint. I'm actually most interested in the how interesting am I in the electronic aspects. I think. The idea of being able to print logic circuits on plastics, tin cans with adverts on them and things like that, it sounds almost horrendous and a bit Blade Runner-y, but I think it'll be fun.
Bobby, any uses for plastics?
Man-made fabrics that aren't as itchy and uncomfortable. bring me some cotton any day. Polyester, all that stuff, it makes me very uncomfortable.
What clothing are you talking about?
Well, it's when I go bodybuilding, you know, wearing my spandex catsuit. Yeah, it's not great.
What I'm quite fascinated by is this whole range of self-cleaning fabrics that are being developed. So you might never have to wash your clothes again. I just don't know if this is going to be possible in the future. But that self-healing and self-repairing. And this whole sort of branch of science and polymers and fabrics that they're developing, these really quite interesting new materials.
OK, well, it's time to draw a plastic veil over this week's show. If you want to get in touch about anything we've discussed, email science@guardian.co.uk, head to the blog, or make your way over to myspace.com/guardianscience. If you liked what you've heard, why not investigate the Science Weekly back catalogue? You'll find a full archive of our shows at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts. My thanks to everyone in the pod, Bobby Johnson, Ian Sample, Nell Bowes, and our special guest, Susan Mossman. Science Weekly is produced by the inimitable Ben Green, and believe me, you don't want to imitate him. I've been Alec Jarre. What say we do this all over again next week?
Guardian Unlimited.